This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Stage and studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio. With me is Bill Foster, executive director of the Northwest Film Center and the Portland International Film Festival. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And with him is Brian Lindstrom, who's one of the Portland filmmakers featured at the festival with his documentary, Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie. Welcome to Stage and Studio, officially this time, you know, in person this time, because you've been featured. Make and Reed did a feature of you about 2 years ago.
And that's right,
so
when we were editing.
Now
yes.
We have you in the studio, so welcome,
well,
Brian.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Dee Mae.
Well, Bill, let's turn to a festival overview. I know there's too much to talk about, so we're just going to give a little bit of, you know, highlighted overview. We heard some music from Werner Herzog's film Happy People, which is a documentary about the people in a village in far north Russia. And that's one of the 136 films shown at the festival this year. I mean, 93 are features and 43 are short films. And they come from and represent about 44 different countries. Is that right?
It's a global overview. You get a lot of different perspectives. About 18 of the films are documentaries, and you could just actually go to all the documentaries if you were actually going to invest yourself in 18 films.
Oh, your recommendation, because you really wanted to talk about some of the documentaries.
Well, I just think
today.
They're always a popular program thread, but this year I think is a real diverse.
I think it's a very strong year for documentaries.
This festival and in general, documentary filmmaking, for all kinds of reasons, the technology and the barriers to making and engaging the world has diminished a lot over the last decades. And so now people are out and about in the world, you know, far away, as Herzog's film is, giving that kind of perspective to right here in Portland, people, you know, engaging in interesting things. And so
sort of a documentary world, too. I mean, we're living in a time where it's probably the most technically easiest way to document yourself and to document other people, both with technology, but also just because I think people are more open to that, perhaps.
I think so. I think people are better informed and more engaged on all kinds of levels, and they're just the way information can be disseminated now, it just reaches people in lots of different ways, and you don't have to go out of your way as much to see a documentary film or hear documentary radio. Certainly,
we're more connected.
Yeah. And you know, Brian can probably speak to whether the technology makes it easier.
Well,
I don't know about that, but
it depends on what level you're at,
what
right?
What level you're on?
Well, so. Yeah. I do want to talk to Brian, and but I'm always amazed at how many films you actually see before you decide upon these films. Mm-hmm. Do you have any estimate of how many you watch this year?
No, because you watch. You know, in truth, you watch a lot of films where, and the technology is also now, I mean, there's three ways that you wind up seeing films: going to film festivals, people sending you old fashioned screeners, DVDs and Blu-rays and things, and some films actually, and then, everybody has their things on websites now.
Yeah, I saw Brian's film on
you
a
know,
website.
And with passwords so, yeah, or whatever, and yeah. So you can see things. So you don't necessarily, you know, you watch lots of different things, and you don't necessarily watch all of it, and you say, this is really interesting on this subject, and you read about it, and you say, I'm going to watch the whole thing later.
You can make quick decisions.
You can make quick decisions, and so you things sort of narrow, have a way of narrowing down. So, you know, it's hard to say how many films.
I would imagine that it'd be very hard to count. Well, so 44 countries are represented. And the and many are award winners too, and the opening night film is an Oscar submission. It's called Blancavitis.
Blancavitis. Blancavitis, which is Snow White, and
And it's a black and white version, and it's a Spanish film.
It's a Spanish film. It's kind of like if people saw The Artist.
Right. That's what I was thinking. It reminded me of The Artist,
which was sort of a take on Hollywood film in the 20s. This is a take on European silent film in the 20s, and the story is the familiar Snow White saga, you know, convoluted in some ways, but it's a beautiful film.
Well, that's the opening night, which is February 7th, and that's a special night. It's always a special night for the opening, but this year you're featuring several amazing documentaries, and actually, if people want to follow along on nwfilm.org, that's your website, and there's also a link at stageandstudio.org, and you can look at the schedule. This year, you're featuring several amazing documentaries, one from Portland's own Brian Lindstrom, who's with us today, Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie, and I don't know if we just want to play the clip, or do you want to give a little bit of a background before we play the clip? What do you think, Brian?
Let's just play the clip.
Yeah, we'll this is from, I think it's very evocative, so and then let's talk about it.
Okay.
He was a guy that you'd think, he's going to write some great poetry, he's going to do some great art.
This person was part of the original punk rock movement.
He was dealing with inner demons.
He was frightened all the time.
Told me that he was living in hell. Help me, help me. And it wasn't Jim Jim anymore.
It's very difficult for people to recover from a mental illness, and he was managing things well.
10 years of being a police officer, and I've never seen anybody look at me like that with the sheer terror in their eyes. I'll never forget seeing that face, and I knew he was going to run.
Jim was in a bad shape. He needed to be hospitalized again. We felt he had gone off his meds.
I looked up just as the four men were hitting the pavement.
If you try and bite me or kick me, it's going to be really, really bad.
And take some pictures here. Take some pictures.
Kicked him a few times.
Hit him 3 times.
Screaming, don't kill me, don't kill me, don't kill me.
It is my opinion that if he had been transported to the hospital, he probably would have survived.
I don't believe a jail cell is the right place to help mentally ill people deal with their problems.
I don't believe for a second that there was ever any ill intent on any of those three officers.
It sounded to me like he had been beaten to death.
You know, I look at what happened to Jim Jim that day, and I look at the city's response. And I just say, it's not Jim Jim who's crazy.
I'm Demi Roberts, Stage and Studio. We just heard a clip from the documentary about the tragic story of a man struggling with mental illness. It's Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie. And he was struggling with mental illness, and the police officers responsible for his death are all examined, as well as eyewitness accounts. I'm here with Bill Foster of Northwest Film Center and the film's director, Brian Lindstrom. Brian, this has been a really long journey for you in making this film, because we did a feature story on you, Make and Reed did, about 2 years ago. And at that point, you know, you were struggling with gag orders from the police and just all kinds of obstacles beyond the normal obstacles of making a film.
Right. One of the challenges we faced, and when I say we, I mean producer Jason Renault and editor Andrew Saunderson and director of photography John Campbell and writer Matt Davis and myself faced, was that not all the elements of the story were open to us when we started this long journey in 2008. There was a gag order on the film, meaning that I was legally prohibited from interviewing people that were involved in that time at the civil case, the family, or obviously any of the officers involved. Luckily, as time went on and we persevered, things became available to us. And so now, lo and behold, all these years later, we have actual videotaped depositions of the officers involved and extensive interviews with all the key participants. And thus, we're able to do what we had always set out to do, which was to tell the story through the viewpoints of the participants, and also to really try to humanize Jim and get to the person behind the headline, 42-year-old man with schizophrenia dies in police custody.
Well, it goes beyond that, doesn't it? And that's what the whole film is about, is to the extent he had 26 broken bones and a fractured lung, and the police footage is the most gut-wrenching to me of when he was inside police custody and
the jailhouse,
and he was, we heard some of those screams, and yet they took so long to get him help.
Yeah, one of the most disturbing parts of the film, of the many disturbing parts for me, is watching the elapsed time of 6 minutes and 30 seconds while Jim had been, between the time Jim, the jailhouse nurses refused to admit Jim, and the time the officers actually took him away from the jail. And those 6.5 minutes, you know, could literally have saved Jim's life. And then to know that they didn't then, you know, put him in an ambulance. They just put him in the squad car, and they didn't drive what's called Code 3 with sirens, you know, going as fast as they could. They just kind of took their time, and, you know, with the tragic result.
Well, you know, it was so telling on so many levels, and you also interviewed so many people who knew James Chassie and eyewitnesses who were there. There's an amazing photo taken by photographer Jamie Marquez showing Chassie hogtied on the street, and it's just...
You know, Demi, I'm so glad you mentioned that photograph, because I don't know if the case would have resonated the way it did with the public without that photograph. And I also want to say that Jamie Marquez's father was a police officer in the Sacramento Police Department, and Jamie's motivation for taking that picture was kind of a profound respect for good police work, and he felt like he was, you know, viewing something quite opposite of that, and that's why he took that photo.
Well, you interviewed so many people, including KBOO's Ava Lake of Arts Focus, who helped you with this film, and it's just amazing. I actually knew quite a few people that were in the who were friends and eyewitnesses, and it's...
You know what else is interesting about, like, you know, Ava and other people? These were you know, people that grew up with Jim, and then went on to define themselves and have, you know, careers in which they did what they wanted to do, and are now, you know, even nationally known. And it's just, you know, there's Ava Lake, Steve Doughton, Mike Brophy,
Connie Doolin, and
right,
yeah.
You know, all these people.
Well, since then, many of the officers involved had rage issues, and mm-hmm. that's kind of, you know, not interesting, but it just shows that there's a problem here.
Right.
What do you want the outcome to be from people watching this film, the Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie?
Well, I think two things. One would just be to, you know, remind ourselves when we see someone, you know, on the street suffering from mental illness that, you know, that's someone's son or daughter or brother or sister or lover or friend, and, you know, that they deserve our compassion, and that also with the right kind of treatment and support, they can live meaningful, independent lives, which Jim did for the majority of his adult life. The other would be, you know, that we're hoping that this film will spark some civic conversations about, you know, what is a positive interaction between the police and the mentally ill, and what can be done to, you know, just prevent what was such an obvious, avoidable tragedy. One of the things that really kind of breaks my heart watching the film is just to hear the eyewitnesses, you know, uniformly say, clearly this was a man who was gentle and fragile and terribly frightened and not a threat in any way. You know, why were the eyewitnesses making that distinction and the police were not?
You know? Yes. Do you think the police will watch this film, the police department or the officers involved?
I hope so. We've made it available to them, and we'll continue to do so. You know, this is not an anti-police film in any
no.
way. You know, we really, it's a measured film that lets the participants speak for themselves, and we use official documents and videotape depositions to let the officers speak for themselves. And I think in a way the film also humanizes the officers. You know, the audience gets to spend time with them in that environment of the deposition and kind of understand what was going through their mind and what pressures they were facing.
Well, I would hope that maybe this could be used as mental health training too.
Absolutely.
For all professionals, you know,
yeah.
We get the police, the paramedics, everybody who's involved in these kind of, I don't want to say incidents, but these experiences where
Absolutely.
Somebody is out in the public sphere and is crying out for help.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what to do.
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
so I'm hoping that this will be helpful to people on all different levels, as well as being a really engaging film, Brian.
This is very
engaging.
On behalf of editor Andrew Sanderson and Jason Renaud and the rest of the team. I thank you.
Yeah, very, very well done. Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie is showing February 15th at Cinema 21 in Northwest Portland as part of the Portland International Film Festival. To see the whole schedule, visit nwfilm.org, and we'll offer a pair of tickets shortly. You can also read more at stageandstudio.org. You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. We've been talking to filmmaker Brian Lindstrom, and with me is Bill Foster, Executive Director of the Northwest Film Center and the festival. Another documentary that features Portland families during the winter of 2011 and 2012. Let's hear a clip. It's called American Winter.
The next door house, our house, the house across the street, the house three doors down, and the house around the corner were all in foreclosure.
I hear them in bed sometimes saying, "We skip dinner because we need to feed our kids." It makes you feel that it's your fault that they have to pay food for us, and that's wasting their money. Sometimes when I hear that, I cry.
Tomorrow, they're going to auction off my house, my 5 acres here. I'm scared about my situation right now, but I'm also scared about Gerald's situation as he gets older. I got to be here to protect him.
Like, we're going to have to put all of our stuff in storage and then live with my mom again. I'm 26, live with my mom again.
I never thought you I'd never... be getting help from the state, you know?
No,
I told myself
I would never do that. I would never do that.
I never put that in my head.
And the filmmakers are Joe Gantz and Harry Gantz, and it focuses on middle-class families. This is American Winter. Bill, this really shows sort of the very much the non-Portlandia image that we're getting in Portland right now.
Yeah, I think
this is real families, middle-class families that have unexpectedly fallen into poverty and homelessness.
Mm-hmm. It's like... Brian's film in many ways, in that on a macro level, it really calls into our reflection about, you know, what are our values as a society, and what, you know, the notion of the safety net and how we treat people. And it's not just a police issue, or it's everybody's issue about how we tend for our fellow man. And this film, American Winter, did an interesting thing. The filmmakers went to an organization called
211 Info, yeah.
Which is a place for people who are really at the end of their tether.
It's a social services helpline,
and they can call and try and find what kind of help there is for the situation they're in, whether their power's been shut off or their furniture has just been deposited on the sidewalk, literally, and their house locked behind them.
Yeah.
So they went to 211 and they listened for a long time to calls coming in from people, and finally honed down on 8 families and engaged with them, and the whole process of how many families they. To get this, I'm not quite sure, but anyway, they followed these stories, and as the clip you listen to indicates, you know, very moving, profound, non-Portlandia.
Yeah,
this is not about the coffee.
I mean, this
corner.
Is real people, and this is people, middle class families who, you know, are working for minimum wage, which is what, $8.75 now, and really working 14, 16 hour days, some of them, and a lot of them looking for work and not being able to get work or work that will help sustain them.
This is not really about homeless people. This is about people who have through the economy or other health issues, whatever, have, you know, found themselves all of a sudden in a totally uncharted.
Well, some of them just lost a job.
Or whatever.
And it just shows you how easy it is to become homeless, frankly.
And how easy it is, and how.
How fragile.
And that it's, on one hand, invisible. On the other hand, through a film like this, you see that there are lots of folks out there that are really suffering, and that we're ill-equipped as a not just Portland, but as a nation you know, to deal with these issues. And so it's an interesting companion piece to Brian's film.
Have you seen it, Brian?
I haven't. I can't wait. I mean,
I think it really is a great companion piece, like you know, double feature almost. But I think that there's so many similar issues. American Winter shows February 17th at 3 p.m. and February 18th at 7:30 p.m. at Cinemagic. You can check out the whole schedule at NW Film Center. Is it nwfilm.org?
nwfilm.org.
And I also have more info at stageandstudio.org. And now I also want to get to another film. We're sort of skimming by this, but A Fierce Green Fire, which I think will really relate to listeners as well, is a documentary about the history of the environmental movement. It begins with John Muir and the Sierra Club activism. I didn't know the Sierra Club were such activists at that time. And it chronicles the global movement now. Let's hear a clip.
Our little Julie was stillborn. Loss of our child may be a direct result to the chemicals.
Raw sewage was going right down the Hudson River. Air pollution was growing just as fast as new automobiles were coming out.
They didn't build new factories, and they didn't clean up the old ones either.
The dams in the Grand Canyon, that was going to be a fight to the death.
They were going to take the water out of the river, all of it.
To these people, apparently, the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene.
If we do not save the environment, then whatever we do in civil rights or in a war against poverty will be of no meaning, because then we will have the equality of extinction.
And all of a sudden, people said, wait a second, this is not how we have to live.
A Fierce Green Fire, directed by Oscar-nominated Mark Kitchell. It's narrated in five acts by five different celebrities: Robert Redford, Meryl Streep, Ashley Judd, Van Jones, and Isabel Allende. Very important, inspirational document and compact document of grassroots activism by ordinary people facing and fighting environmental threats. And it covers protests by moms at Love Canal, the murder of Chico Mendes, a Brazilian organizer. I mean, it really takes it from an American movement to a global movement within the period of this film. I think it's a very important film, especially I think Portlanders will really relate to this.
Well, I mean, in a place like Portland in Oregon that has such an advanced, you know, regard for the sort of values that, you know, that we want to share, you sort of get lost in like where all this came from. And this film is, this probably could be we were talking about Ken Burns earlier, more like a Ken Burns 5-hour film. It's boiled down into 90 minutes. It's a huge...
I think they did an incredible job
subject,
doing that.
And when you think about, you know, social movements of the last 100 years, environmentalism is a very profound global success story certainly on one level and failures on another.
But
consciousness has been raised, and so starting from guys like John Muir, tracing this whole thing, trying to distill it down into 90 minutes.
It's
a challenge, but nonetheless, a noble effort to try and grasp the big picture here. So it is sort of a primer, and there's lots of stuff in it that you think you might have known.
But you can use it to go and do your own exploration. And to me, the whole thread of this is that it was ordinary people. Each one of these movements started with ordinary people that said, like the moms at Love Canal just said, no, we're not going to take this anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think that was inspiring
inspiring on that level, and you know, cuts directly to the fact that, you know, it is our world. And
we have to do something about it. Or terraform Mars, that's what I always say. But all three of these documentaries, Alien Boy, American Winter, and A Fierce Green Fire, are some of the strongest full-length docs that I've seen at the festival. And I personally think, and I'd like to get your point on this, it's good to see the art of documentary is alive and well, and especially at Portland International Film Festival. Is it hard, Brian, as a documentary maker, to get documentaries shown?
You know, it's always hard to get any film shown, and anytime you get into a festival, you just feel like you've hit the bullseye, you know, and so you just have to kind of keep plugging away and keep entering.
The challenge for documentaries is that they are subject focused, and they tend to, in some regard, preach to a choir. And the people that want to go see a documentary about 60s rhythm and blues singers in Detroit, you know, another one we have in here is about Marilyn Monroe. Even they tend, outside of a broad showcase, the people that hear about them are narrow, and so they have trouble breaking out of their kind of niches. A festival like this gives a broader audience a chance to see a menu of things.
It's a big plate, and a lot of choice. I also like to do a short shout out for Portland filmmakers, Shell White, who has Bird of Flames, and these are the shorts, Joanna Priestley for Pluto, and Ian Barry's film called Box. All incredible short films as well, and I love the short
There's a whole program of
short films. You can get tickets to Portland International Film Festival by calling 503-276-4310 or at the Film Center's Advanced Ticket Outlet at Portland Art Museum at 1119 Southwest Park Avenue, and all through February 23rd from 12 to 6 p.m. You can also get them at nwfilm.org, and we have that info at stageandstudio.org, where you can also hear this interview. We have a pair of tickets to offer to the fourth caller here at KBOO, and the number is 503-231-5106, 231-5106, fourth caller. And Bill Foster, Northwest Film Center, Brian Lindstrom, Alien Boy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dima. It's so great to
talk with you both. Before we go today, Portland singer Matthew Gailey is releasing his debut EP, Beasts in Babylon, Friday, February 8th at 9 p.m. at the Secret Society, located at 116 Northeast Russell Street in Portland. He's got special guests, the Quadrophones and cellist Galen Cohen, and also Stephen Mark Bedouin. For more info, go to MatthewGailey.com. And that's it for Stage and Studio. My thanks to KBOO engineer Janet Anderson. You can always find podcasts of our shows at stageandstudio.org or iTunes Podcast. And like us on the Stage and Studio Facebook page, or tweet me at Stage, the letter, and Studio. Till next time, I'm Dima Roberts. We're going out with a song by Matthew Gailey's from his EP, Beasts in Babylon.
Daniel saw the stone, it was rolling through Babylon. Ezekiel saw a wheel in a wheel. Well, take a look around now, see what you find, then come on back and tell me just how you feel. Sing it, like everyone is last in line. Well, I'm trying so hard. Well, things are getting harder. Well, I just don't want to be left behind.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, standing in for Ava Lake, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week our guest is Julia Dolan, the Minor White Curator of Photography at the Portland Art Museum. Julia has curated the show Carrie Mae Weems' Three Decades of Photography and Video, which is a retrospective of the work of the artist who grew up in Portland. The show opened on Saturday and runs until May 19th. Welcome, Julia. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So Carrie Mae Weems, she's an internationally known photographer who was born and raised in Portland until she was 17. Tell us a little bit about her biography.
Carrie has such a wonderful biography. Actually, it was really great to have dinner with her in the Pearl last night. She was talking about, as a youth of about 16 years of age or so, driving into the Pearl to pick up her father from work because he used to work in that space, which, of course, in about 1970 was a very, very different place from what it is now. So it's been wonderful to learn from her about her time here in Portland. She was already politically active when she was here in Portland. She was very interested in the arts, not necessarily the visual arts yet, more the performing arts. So when she was 17 years old, she approached her father and said, I think I need to go. I need to go out on my own. And he supported her in doing so. And she actually moved to San Francisco and became a dancer with Anna Halprin's dance workshop there. And it was at, in her early 20s that she discovered photography. She was given the gift of a camera and started thinking about how photography could be used as a tool in terms of protests sometimes or civic action. And from there, she went to art school. She got a BFA and in photography, and then she also received an MFA from the University of California, and also studied folklore at Berkeley. So that is really the underpinning of her photographic work. And from there, she moved sort of back and forth between California and New York City, thinking about photography, working in photography, first in a documentary style, and then in perhaps what we would say more of a contemporary or postmodern style, where she was thinking more about really setting up photographs that would allow her to provide a narrative in a more structured way than perhaps documentary photographs could.
Just say something about Anna Halperin. What kind of dance, or was it street theater? What was it?
It was a dance group, a workshop, known for very sort of avant-garde work, which makes perfect sense, I think, if you know about Carrie or are learning about Carrie, sort of being on the forefront of